The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments Monday in a case that could ultimately have big financial consequences for unions. The High Court is considering a challenge to an Illinois law that allows unions that represent government employees to collect fees from workers who did not join. We're talking about this case, Janice versus Ask Me, on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's begin the conversation with Andrew Hanna. He is an employment and immigration reporter for Politico. He wrote the recent piece, "The Supreme Court Could Cripple Public Unions in the Run-Up to the 2018 Midterms." Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Well, in yesterday's oral arguments, justices seemed divided along ideological lines. Four liberal justices seemed to side with the unions. Conservatives on the bench hinted that they'd side with individual workers. What did you make of the oral arguments?
Well, the thing about this case is that it is remarkably similar to a case from 2016 called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Union Association. The difference now is that Justice Gorsuch was not on the court at the time, so the court deadlocked 4-4. So everyone's been waiting for months to see what Justice Gorsuch was going to say, not necessarily with the idea that he was a swing vote, but in that we've never really heard what his opinion on this whole issue is yet. And surprisingly, he didn't say a single word.
So what did you make of that, not weighing in? Because, you know, Judge Clarence Thomas rarely speaks from the bench either.
That's true. It's more that people were kind of building up this moment of seeing what Gorsuch was going to say to give some clarity on this issue. And there had been no indication beforehand that, you know, Justice Gorsuch was going to do something similar to Justice Thomas. I think that he didn't say anything for this very reason, because, you know, he's just trying to reduce speculation about what his decision is going to be, and give himself and the other justices more time to actually talk it through before they make a final decision.
Let's step back and understand what are fair share fees. This case centers around these agency fees. How do they work?
Right. So basically, if you're given two options, if you're working in a public sector job that has a public sector union in a non-right-to-work state. So your options are be in the union, which means pay the union dues, or not be in the union, but you're still compelled to pay these agency fees or fair share fees. They're definitely less than the union dues, but the idea behind them is that they go to cover the costs of collective bargaining. So they go to fund the parts of union work that is not explicitly political advocacy.
So why do 22 states allow fair share fees for employees in the public sector? Because here in Wisconsin, it's not one of those states. In 2015, Wisconsin became a right-to-work state.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's sort of the default position, actually, to have these fair share fees. In 1977, the Supreme Court ruled in Abood versus Detroit Board of Education that these fees were legal. However, the National Labor Relations Act allows states to make decisions about whether to restrict their usage or not. So Wisconsin is one of the other 28 states that have decided to do that.
So what values is the High Court considering in this case in Janice versus AFSCME? What's at play here from a moral standpoint?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are, I mean, two different stakes that we're looking at. So from the side that's arguing on Janice's behalf against unions, the conservative side position, the First Amendment is really the issue that's at play here. It's whether or not forcing people to pay these fees constitutes a violation of the First Amendment. If you look at the arguments being made by Janice's lawyers, they're pretty broad in what they consider to be political speech. It's not simply the union's activity canvassing for certain candidates or donating campaigns, which the fees that the agency fees don't actually go to. They're restricted by law from going to those. What they're arguing is that because public sector unions are arguing and negotiating with the government, that right there is inherently political. that's taking a position. That is a violation of the First Amendment if you force someone to do that without their consent.
Talking right now with Andrew Hanna. He is a employment and immigration reporter for Politico, and he has been covering the Supreme Court case, Janus versus AFSCME. We're talking about the case a day after oral arguments before the justices yesterday, fiery arguments. We're learning more about the case and what it means to unions across the country. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you part of a labor union? What's your job? And what do you get out of it for your investment? Do you voluntarily hand over your money, or is it a mandatory in your industry? And what element in yesterday's oral arguments has you thinking about union membership? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Andrew, let's talk about the role of money in this case, because there have been opinions out there that this could really be a setback, depending on how the court decides, a financial setback to unions.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of money at stake on both sides. On the plaintiff's side, the campaign's being bankrolled by some very large conservative donors like the Bradley Foundation and the Koch brothers, who have been donating lots of money over the years to organizations like National Right to Work to find cases sort of like this, champion them, and push forward what they believe their idea of public sector unionization should be. On the other side, you've got lots and lots of money flowing from these public sector unions to primarily Democratic Party candidates in election cycles. We did a crunch of some of the numbers and found that in the 2016 election campaign cycle, at least 6% of total Democratic liberal organization donations came from public sector unions. That's nothing to sneeze at.
So how do unions use the money they collect from public workers who are not non-union members? You said it was pretty broad, but could not be limited to politics. Explain that a little bit further.
So I think what I actually meant was that if the fees are collected from the non-union members, the agency fees, they're legally restricted from going into use in political canvassing or going into use in donations to the Democratic Party, for example. What I was saying is that the argument being made by the plaintiff is that that doesn't matter, that anything, their argument is that anything a public sector union does by virtue of being public sector is political. That's why the argument is so broad, and that's why this case could cripple public sector unions, because the court agrees with that interpretation of union activity in the First Amendment. Then basically, there's no way that public sector unions can force people to pay these fees. Because then they would be forced to do something they don't agree with. They're effectively kind of derives from the same argument that money is free speech.
Let's go to Nate, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Nate. Go ahead.
Hi. I honestly hope this loses. I thank the guest for pointing out that, in spite of all the claims about politics, that the fees this man pays are not going into politics, but can actually go into services like if the union's required to defend him in case somebody wants to fire him without just cause. And that's a situation even in supposed right-to-work states where unions are legally obliged to do that if a worker comes to them with a concern.
Nate, thank you so much for the call. And so there are protections here at stake. Are there not, Andrew?
Not really sure what you mean on that one, but I think that I absolutely agree with Nate in that there's a reason why the plaintiff is taking such a broad view of these activities. There's also one of the things that I didn't get to mention is that the argument being made by some of the union lawyers, how a lot of it has to deal with union peace, which is another duty of the court to maintain union peace. That's been part of Labor Relations Act going back for decades. One of the arguments made by AFSCME lawyer was that if the court overruled its previous president, that there could be untold union strife across the country. And that's actually something that they need to take into account.
The U.S. Supreme Court justices spent about an hour yesterday hearing oral arguments in a challenge to the Illinois law that allows unions representing government employees to collect fees from workers who choose not to join. The case is Janus versus AFSCME, and we are talking about it with Andrew Hanna. He's been covering the case. He's an employment and immigration reporter for Politico. What part of yesterday's oral arguments have you thinking about union membership? Does collective bargaining have a role in our modern economy? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll return after a news update. During Monday's U.S. Supreme Court oral arguments in the case Janus versus AFSCME, there were colorful and occasionally angry comments from the justices. But Justice Neil Gorsuch asked no questions during the session to argue the Janus versus AFSCME case. We're talking about the case and the repercussions on unions on this Hour of the Morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Andrew Hanna stays with us. He's been covering the case as an employment and immigration reporter at Politico. Are you part of a labor union? What's your job and what do you get out of your investment? Do you want to be part of collective bargaining? Why or why not? Let's discuss. 800-642-1234. Let's go to Stefan first in Milwaukee. Hi, Stefan.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for the opportunity. I've worked for the state as a state employee for a couple of decades. I've been on both sides of the issue, management and represented. My question or comment is that it seems to me that common sense may dictate that those that do not want to be represented through joining the union or making the payments should not be represented, and they should represent themselves. So those that don't want the union representation shouldn't get it in bargaining and should be able to be on their own to negotiate.
Stefan, thanks for calling in. Let's get Andrew now to respond. Andrew?
Sure. So I think that in an ideal world, there would be a way for those who choose to be in the union, those who do not, to have outcomes that fit their specific preference. We all want what we vote or choose for to be the specific outcome for ourselves. The thing is that when unions engage in collective bargaining, they are supposed to be bargaining on behalf of all the workers, because that's where the leverage in the negotiations come from. That's why, if you know, in a card check election, non-right-to-work states, you have a majority of members voting for a union, then they become the selected representative for all the workers. If you start having different groups of people representing, you know, different employees in the workplace, you're effectively kind of having separate unions competing with each other, or associations. That's not really good for workplace peace, and that's not necessarily very good for negotiating either.
Andrew, who belongs to unions today? Are they the traditional steel workers we think of from decades ago?
No. Certainly there are these people. There are plenty of miner, for example, are the United Mine Workers are very active still in terms of speaking up and advocating their position. But over the years, public sector employees really have become the dominant form of unionized worker in American politics. So you're just as likely to see, if you're thinking profile of union workers, public school teacher as a steel worker.
Let's go to Kevin now in Crandon. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, I just want... Hello?
Hi, Kevin. You're there.
Oh. Yep. What I wanted to say was I was in the Construction Laborers Union about 15 years before injuries forced me out of the game. And it was the best job I ever had by far. You got paid a decent wage. You got health benefits, pension benefits, vacation pay. You had somebody to stand up for you if there were disputes on the job with the company or contractors. And I think these people, like this guy that brought this suit, that he should just man up and pay the dues. If he's benefiting from them, then he should pay the dues just like everybody else. It's just...
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for bringing up Kevin seeing the positive sides he sees for being part of unions. What happens, Andrew, if the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court side with the public worker?
If they side with the union, then nothing really changes. Then the status quo we have in place remains in place. That was essentially the ruling that the court reached in Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association in 2016. The court deadlocked 4-4 back then and reverted to a pro-labor decision at a lower court. And that's where we've been ever since.
What happens then if they go the other way?
If they go the other way, there are pretty dramatic consequences for all public sector unions across the country. A simple way to think about this is that it would effectively lead to right to work for public sector unionized workers in all 50 states.
So what should we be watching for here while we await, it could be months, for the High Court to provide an opinion in Janus versus AFSCME?
Well, I wish I knew that question. If there's a way for me to get my hands on what they're thinking ahead of time, I would be trying to report that one out.
Andrew, I mean, we're seeing picketing in West Virginia by teachers, other union activity around the country. Could that be playing into perhaps what the justices are mulling over?
I don't think it's supposed to, but as we know, the justices are human beings. So they read the news and they see what's going on in the world around them, just like everyone else. I think it'd be very hard to avoid letting something like that filter through and at least, you know, nudge your thinking one way or the other.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, I was very happy to be here.
Andrew Hanna is an employment and immigration reporter for Politico. He wrote a recent piece titled "The Supreme Court Could Cripple Public Unions in the Run-Up to the 2018 Midterms." On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments. In this case, we're talking about Janus versus AFSCME. A ruling is expected in a few months. Here's the crux of the legal argument. Does it violate a public employee's First Amendment rights to be forced to pay an agency fee for services that unions provide on his or her behalf? Agency fees, or these fair share fees, are different from union dues. They pay for services like collective bargaining that we've been talking about, like grievance resolutions, but they do not pay for direct lobbying or political donations. Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Now let's bring in attorney Pat Hughes. He's president of the Liberty Justice Center based in Chicago. The organization represents the plaintiff in the U.S. Supreme Court case, Janus versus AFSCME. Pat, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what did you take away from yesterday's oral arguments?
Well, it was a fascinating day. What I took away from it is there are, you know, eight justices from the prior case, the Friedrichs case, that are split 4-4. The so-called conservative justices, their questions seemed to indicate, and their prior rulings seemed to indicate, that they were on our side, and the four so-called liberal justices seemed to be on the side of AFSCME and the Illinois Attorney General, leaving Judge Gorsuch, who said nothing, as the seeming deciding vote.
How did you get involved with Mark Janus, the Illinois state worker whose case has made its way to the high court?
So originally, the governor of the state of Illinois was dismissed from a lawsuit that was filed because he didn't have standing. And so we found Mark Janus through contacts and mutual associates, and he was upset about paying these dues because he's not a member of the union. He doesn't want the union to represent him. He doesn't think the union speaks for the things that he believes in. And so we decided to represent him in the case in the hopes of implementing the Friedrichs decision once it came down. And like your prior guest commented, that never came to be because Justice Scalia passed away. We were the next case in line, and so that's how we ended up getting to the United States Supreme Court. And, you know, our position is a very clear one. Everything a public sector union does, everything, regardless of its direct political activity, like you mentioned in the intro, or collective bargaining, is political. You know, when the government is being lobbied by a public sector union for salaries, for fees, for millions upon millions upon millions of dollars of taxpayer money, in any other context, that would be called lobbying. It's a political activity. And no American citizen, my client included, should be forced to subsidize or associate with political activity that they don't believe in, and that's the crux of our case.
Political activity, though, you're making here in this argument, that's a really big tent, touching on all areas of what the unions are trying to do. How do you respond to that?
So it's not a big tent. It's that a union is a private entity in the public sector union context, that everything they're doing is an association with government, right? So when a public sector union goes and asks the government for money in collective bargaining, they're asking for taxpayer dollars that impact an entire populace of people. It impacts the budget. It impacts how high taxes are. That is, in any other context, if it wasn't the union doing it, it would be considered lobbying, and there would be a direct political activity. And Abood has accepted that prior case in 1977. The reality of it is, that's all political activity. And if you want to join a union and be part of a public sector union, God bless you. You should do it. You should be part of it. You should support the things you believe in, unions included. We're not opposed to unions or collective bargaining. But if you don't want to be part of that union, if you don't stand for the things that they stand for, if you're not a member of the union, you shouldn't be forced to subsidize them with your money out of your paycheck. And our client is forced to do that, along with 5 million other people across the country. And he doesn't want his First Amendment right to be checked at the door just because there's a job in state government that he enjoys, that he's good at, and that he's able to provide a public service through.
But if you eliminate collective money from people who are public workers but are not union members, don't these people benefit from collective bargaining but bear none of the cost?
So the argument that the unions make is that the people who are non-union members who don't pay will then benefit from collective bargaining. And that argument, in my opinion, is specious. In our case, in AFSCME, the unions lobbied hard for the right to represent all of those workers, even though collective bargaining on behalf of the non-union workers doesn't add any cost to them. It's a fixed cost for bargaining, and every additional worker doesn't add cost to that. The reason they did that is they want access to the money that the non-union workers would provide. They want access to those workers so they can contact them, so they can persuade them to join the union. So they wanted it to be this way, and now that part of the structure violates the constitutional rights of non-members, they're complaining that they're having to represent people who aren't paying. If they don't want to do that, they can go back and lobby the government to take those people out of it. I can tell you from my perspective, our client would love to just be able to negotiate on his own and working his job on his own. The problem is he's not allowed to. If he's in that position, if he's working for the state of Illinois, he's got to be in that context where he's paying those union dues. And he'd rather just be on his own.
In a letter to the governor of Illinois a week ago, you called requiring non-union members to pay dues is un-American. What do you mean by that?
So it's a violation of the First Amendment rights of my client and others to free speech, because they're being forced to subsidize with their money the speech of a union that they don't agree with through collective bargaining and otherwise, and they're a violation of their First Amendment rights to free association because they're being forced to associate with a group that they don't want to associate with. Forcing people to give up their First Amendment rights through coercion is un-American. That's what I mean by that.
Attorney Pat Hughes is with us, president of the Liberty Justice Center, the organization representing the plaintiff in the U.S. Supreme Court case Janus versus AFSCME. Let's go to the phones now. Barry is with us in Spooner. Hi, Barry.
Good morning. I was just thinking, as this case moved on, they state that there's restricted funds from the non-union members, which is true, but they don't restrict the funds from the union members, so it's commingled funds. So that the whole argument that it isn't used for lobbying is incorrect if the union members can put less into that expense. So it can't stand. It has to go towards the plaintiff.
Pat Hughes, your response.
I like Barry. That's a great point. That's the commingled fund argument, that you're collecting all these funds and it's very difficult to differentiate between where they're going and where they're not going. In the context of our case, the justices didn't look into that issue specifically, but Barry makes a very, very good point. But it doesn't matter. I just want to be clear. It doesn't matter if the funds were segregated out or not, because funds used for collective bargaining are still violative. Collecting those funds against someone's will are still violative of the First Amendment, because the act of collective bargaining is a political act in the public sector context. And I want to be clear about that. This won't impact private sector unions. Private sector collective bargaining, you're not bargaining with the government, so you're not lobbying a governmental entity for taxpayer money. So it's a different circumstance. This would only impact public sector unions, and that's why it's a violation of the First Amendment.
Let's go to Colleen, who has a comment in Darlington. Hi, Colleen.
Yeah, I just, you know, since Citizens United made it that money is free speech, then doesn't this contradict everything that they said?
Pat Hughes.
Does our case contradict Citizens United? No. I mean, ours is consistent with it. The idea that my client, Mr. Janus, is being required to give money to subsidize the activities of the union, his money is subsidizing speech. So in that context, giving the money is the speech part of it. Because that money allows the union to participate in speech with his money through collective bargaining and of course, to Barry's prior point, potentially through direct political activity. So it's consistent with the decision Citizens United.
Well, the Economic Policy Institute has data that shows 1.5 million African-American women work in the public sector. Researchers say unions help reduce pay gaps that happen because of both race and gender. Do you have concerns about affecting these women if Janus prevails and unions have less money to lobby on behalf of workers?
Well, characterizing it as, do I have concerns about those women? I have concerns about all workers in the state, regardless in the country, regardless of who they are. And this will benefit all workers, including the people that you just referenced. If those folks want to join a union and be represented by a union and take the benefits that they believe the union is going to offer in the public sector context, then they're free to do that. We're not looking to end collective bargaining. The unions are still going to exist. But if those same people you're talking about value their right to choose, then they should have that right as well, whether they're female, whether they're African-American. Regardless, they should have the right to choose. And that's what we're seeking. We want all workers to be able to make that decision. If they want to join a union because they think it benefits themselves, then they should. God bless them. If they don't, they shouldn't be forced to check their First Amendment rights at the door when they go to their job.
So as we wrap up here, what do you think is going to come out in the legal opinion of the court, perhaps in a couple months? And what do you want people to consider all over as they form opinions about Janus versus AFSCME, your case?
So I'm hopeful that we're going to prevail. Obviously, I don't have a crystal ball. I think it's 4-4, and I'm hopeful that Justice Gorsuch will see it our way. There's no indication one way or the other from yesterday how he sees it, but I'm optimistic because I think our case is correct. And I think it stands with recent jurisprudence that the court has laid down. And so I'm hopeful that they're going to rule on our decision, and we should know. We'll certainly know before the end of June. What I want people to know from this is Mark Janus, Liberty Justice Center, the people who are fighting for this issue, what we care about are First Amendment rights and freedom of workers to make decisions for themselves in the workplace and not be coerced to be part of an organization they don't want to be part of. But we are not opposed to unions. We're not opposed to collective bargaining. And ultimately, I hope that the unions recognize that if we do prevail, they have an opportunity here to provide better service, to recruit people based on the wares that they're trying to sell.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Pat Hughes, Attorney Pat Hughes, president of the Liberty Justice Center based in Chicago, the organization representing the plaintiff in the U.S. Supreme Court case, Janus versus AFSCME. News is next. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments Monday in a case that could bring a financial blow to public unions in America. The case is Janus versus American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Council 31. The case is better known as Janice versus AFSCME. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How have you seen unions change business in the past? Are they responsible for growth and prosperity, or have you seen downsides to union power? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tweet us with your observations, your questions at WPR Mornings. Now let's bring in Celine McNicholas. She is Labor Counsel for the Economic Policy Institute. She's part of EPI's Perkins Project on Worker Rights and Wages, which tracks the Trump administration's wage and employment policies. Celine, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What was your reaction to the oral arguments in front of the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday?
Well, I would say that I am not hopeless that the court may actually sort of refuse to take the plaintiff's invitation to overturn longstanding precedent and really injure public sector workers in the process. But I will say that I think the smart money, given what's happened to the Supreme Court, the composition, and finally confirming Justice Gorsuch, I think the writing, for better or for worse, is on the wall for working people. But it will be very interesting to see how the court does the gymnastics that it will have to do with far-reaching precedent to reach that outcome.
Far-reaching precedent, 40 years since this type of ruling came down. Janice supporters say this is an issue of workers' rights. How do you view this case?
I think this is absolutely an issue of workers' rights, but I think it goes beyond that as well. I think this is really about whether a relatively small group of wealthy donors backed by corporate spending are going to be able to rewrite our nation's most basic labor rules about how public sector employers, that's what the state is in this context, an employer negotiate with their workforce. And that's really what's at stake here. This is the third bite at the apple. This issue has come before the court several times in the last 10 years, and I think that they're finally going to get the verdict that I absolutely hate to say, but that they've bought and paid for with the Supreme Court seat going to Justice Gorsuch.
You recently broke down the numbers that show African American women hold a disproportionate share of public sector jobs. What does that mean, and how does it relate to this case?
Sure. Women and people of color are overrepresented in the public workforce. So that means that they're disproportionately have a stake in this particular verdict. Public sector employment is one place where working people of color are actually not suffering the same sort of wage gaps that they're suffering in other sectors of the economy. And that is in no small way attributable to the benefits of collective bargaining. So they have a great deal at stake. And you actually saw that in several of the amicus briefs that were filed in this case that made the point that, people of color will be disproportionately impacted by the court's holding in this matter.
Federal statute makes it illegal to force a worker to join a union, but the plaintiff here is saying that that's exactly what's happening when his money goes to collective bargaining work. Is that right?
Right. That's essentially the plaintiff in this case is arguing that it is a violation of his First Amendment right for the state and his union to have reached an agreement that requires him as a non-member to pay a fee for the benefits of the union representation that he receives. None of that fee goes to the purely political, lobbying that a union may engage in other areas. This is really just to support the collective bargaining agreement and any fees associated with a grievance that the individual worker may have with the state as his or her employer. That's really what the fair share fee is. His argument, the argument of the National Right to Work Foundation that has litigated many of these cases, is that essentially all aspects of public sector employment are inherently political. That's not been something that the court has been willing to accept in the past. That was the critical underpinning of Abood, the case you mentioned, that's now 40 plus years in precedent, where the court did not choose to ascribe the higher protection, First Amendment protection, to issues of employment in the public sector. The argument has come back around in this case.
Let's go to Kathy in West Bend with who wants to make a point. Kathy, go ahead.
Yes, I am a retired state employee. I was a member of AFSCME. That being said, I know that at least in the state of Wisconsin, and I had assumed nationwide, employees who were chose not to be involved in anything political with the union had the right to opt out and request a refund of the point of the part of their dues that went to lobbying and political action committees. But it's amazing that at this stage of the game, someone still says, oh, no, I don't want the benefits, but they are willing to accept. I mean, I don't want the responsibility, but they are willing to accept the increased pay, the safety protections, et cetera, that a union can offer to them.
Kathy, was that refund system working well for your coworkers?
It appeared to be. I know that with regard to hazardous work situations, they had the right, the same as any union member, to say, excuse me, Mr. or Mrs. Supervisor, this is kind of hazardous, and I don't want to be doing this particular job without more safety items being taken care of. And when they got their paycheck, they were paid the same amount per hour as union members.
Kathy, thank you so much for your personal story. Let's get Celine to give a response. Celine?
I think that Kathy's point is well taken. What this really is about, it's not about these fees supporting political lobbying activity. That there has been a long-standing prohibition on that. You're really talking about whether or not an individual worker who is benefiting from the higher wages and enhanced job protections, not having to go into that hazardous work site, whether that individual worker is going to contribute his or her fair share. And there's been a great deal made about what this will overall, you know, do to the financial situation of unions, but I think scaling it back and looking at it through the, you know, the story that Kathy just shared, what this is really about is, are, you know, the workers who do pay their dues, pay their fair share fees, are they going to have to carry, you know, sort of essentially that free rider, that worker who works next to them on the manufacturing line, is down, you know, one classroom down the hallway, are they asking their coworker to pay for the benefits that they're receiving? And there's something fundamentally, I think, that smacks us all as unfair about that construction. And that's really what is at stake in this case.
Let's go to Ray in Manitowoc. Hi, Ray.
Hey, good morning. Good subject. Being a lifelong union member and a participant at union meetings, I full well know that your union meetings are set up as democracies. We hear about freedom of speech. You have the right to show up at a union meeting, argue your case, make a motion. Everything, including all the officers, in fact, is voted on. At the national level, the officers you elect are voting on these other issues, who not to support. As I see it, most of the majority of the people who are anti-union, they're looking to bankrupt the union so we cannot negotiate higher wages. We cannot take grievances to arbitration when there's an unjustifiable dismissal, which sets up workplace precedents, which diminishes the environment for all of us. These are discussions I don't hear. Just a bunch of people whining about, on one side, people that don't even go to the union meetings that think they know, or big business that's definitely right to work, set out to bankrupt the union so they cannot collectively raise everybody's boats.
Celine, are unions set up just like democracy, as Ray is saying?
Yes, absolutely. That is at their core what they are supposed to be. They're supposed to be a representation of the workers that are a part of the union, whether they elect to be members or they certainly, as was just pointed out, continue to have a voice, whether they're non-members and are able to participate in whether it's meetings or, you know, cast votes. All of those things are part of the process.
How should people think about the funding that's being poured into this litigation? And what do you find about donors on different sides of this case?
You know, I think in terms of Wisconsin, you have a unique perspective on some of the funders here, because much of the backing were organizations that were involved around the fight, around Act 10 and some of these legislative fights. The same groups that have contributed to those causes are absolutely at the foundation of this litigation as well. And, you know, that's how you get this this issue before the court 3 times in 5 years. You know, you spend the money necessary to litigate all the way up to the Supreme Court until you ultimately, you know, get the verdict that you want. And so when you're looking at these organizations, you're seeing they're spending money on, you know, in state legislative battles, they're spending money in, you know, congressional campaigns, state representative campaigns, and you're also now seeing this kind of consistent willing to spend money on litigation as well.
So as we begin to wrap up here, Celine, what do you want people to consider as they form their own opinions about Janus versus AFSCME?
I hope that people will take the time to look at who is behind the litigation, who has been funding this litigation. But I also, hope that, I know that when things are in front of the Supreme Court, they may seem that they're far away, that the impact is here in D.C. And I would just say that, similar to the response that I have found, you know, very encouraging around Act 10 and all of the wonderful political grassroots outgrowth of in response to that, I would hope that people would take a similar interest. I've been heartened watching the studies that have come out of what's happened around Act 10 in Wisconsin, people kind of becoming aware of the damaging effect on public services, on the workers that deliver those public services, and I would hope that that would just continue to spread, you know, nationwide, and there would be a significant response to such a critical case before the court.
Celine, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Celine McNicholas is labor counsel for the Economic Policy Institute. She's part of the EPI's Perkins Project on Workers' Rights and Wages, which tracks the Trump administration's wage and employment policies. Earlier in the hour, we spoke with Liberty Justice Center President Attorney Pat Hughes, representing the plaintiff in the case, and Politico reporter Andrew Hanna got us started in the conversation. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Naeja Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.